Maybe I should start by giving a background to this course. It's actually really happy to see so many people because it started off in Fotini's office, and I was trying to explain something to her about the time or whatever, and I realized that there was all kinds of intuition that had built up over thinking about these things for a couple months that I had to explain. So I kept going back and back and back and back. And at some point, Fotini goes, "You know what? Why don't you just sort of start from the beginning and put together a series of notes and give lectures, and then I'll send an email and see if anyone else is interested." So that's basically how the course has started. And then we sent an email, and I think we had about 10 replies in an hour from people who are interested. So I think that Mark's principle and the Julian's stuff is the type of thing that a lot of people like to think about and would like to know. We were talking about this earlier, but the amount of time that it takes to actually learn in detail enough to be able to read Julian's papers is too much time for people to actually spend to learn it. So I think that what I'm going to try to do here is just make it easy for everyone and go through, start from the beginning, and try to convey the ideas and give you enough basic tools to be able to sort of read through his papers and have a fairly good idea of what's going on. So that's the basic goal for the course, I think. I'm a physicist, and Mach's principle has sort of historically been a fairly philosophical topic. So I'm not going to claim to be rigorous about the philosophy. I mean, one of the problems with Mach's principle, I said this in the sort of description of the course, is that he was more of a philosopher than a physicist, so he was very vague about it. He wasn't vague. He was specific about what he said, but he wasn't. He didn't put in any concrete model. And so, Einstein sort of used a lot of what Mach said to motivate general relativity, but even Einstein wasn't very precise about how he implemented these ideas. Now, the funny thing is, at the end of the day, he came to a theory in general relativity, which, according to Julian Barber, is relational. But it took, I don't know, till 1982 to actually get a very precise definition of what that meant. And so that's what we're going to be talking about. And I'm going to try to stick to that. All right. So I'm going to stick to one particular proposal for how to implement Mach's principle. And it's something that I can write on the board and something that I can explain to you. And then it'll just be up to you to decide whether or not that's actually a valid sort of expression of Mach's principle or not. So I'm going to try to stay out of philosophy. I'm also not going to always be mathematical. I'm also not a mathematician. So if we talk about gauge theory, and I use fiber cords from fiber bundles, I'm not going to maybe be as precise as a mathematician would be. But so, all right. Good. So I figured in a course on Mach's principle, I should probably talk about what Mach's principle is. And I just told you I'm not going to be rigorous with the philosophy, but I figured I may as well throw up a quote. Mach had two principles. We talk about Mach's principle as one principle, but there's sort of a statement of two very separate ideas. One of them is temporal relationalism, the other one is spatial relationalism. And so I want to start with the second one, which is spatial relations. So I'm just going to throw this up. And this is a quote from 1872, it's the Mechanics. So I'll just read it. "It is utterly beyond our power to measure the changes of things by time. Quite the contrary, time is an abstraction at which we arrive by means of the changes of things, made because we are not restricted to any one definite measure, all being interconnected." So the reason for me putting this up is because something that Julian says all the time is, time is change. And, that's supposed to be a Machian principle. And so you can really see that that's true, especially in this sentence here. Time is an abstraction at which we arrive by means of the changes of things. Right? So, hopefully, maybe by the end of the day, probably next session, I'll go through a specific model where you can measure time, and even I think Hans can talk on this next week. You can measure time, and you can show that the Newtonian definition of time is actually equivalent to just a sort of measure of how everything is changing in the world.
What does measure mean?
A measure, not like a measure, like an integral measure. A measure.
Duration.
A duration. Yeah. Well, it's a
measurement result.
Yeah. Sure. A measurement. Yeah. It's a. Here, when they mean measure, they mean sort of like a quantity. So it's a way to determine the quantity of how much has changed in the world. So here it's just words on a slide. But in a second, we'll try to make that very precise and definite. But I just want to prove to you that this is really what Mark said. And so. I think the way that I want to do this is to say, go through this sort of overview of the basic concepts and then list the outline as I'm going along. So here's the outline. And the very first thing that I'm going to talk about is temporal relationalism. And the way that Julian actually implements this idea mathematically is through something called Jacobi's principle. But before we do this, as a warm up to sort of the idea of sort of where we're going with this, and also as a way to review canonical quantization. Because probably a lot of you already know about quantization, but I think it's still good to go over. I'm going to talk about just a simpler model, parameterized particle mechanics. Parameterized particle mechanics. And this is just a model of non-relativistic particles moving in absolute space. But you do a little trick where you make time a dynamical variable, and then you get an equation of motion for that variable, and it happens to share a lot of the features of this temporally relational theory. But the next thing is you actually get a handle on exactly what's going on. So one thing that I want to emphasize is that these are just models of non-relativistic particles moving in flat Euclidean space. And what's interesting about these models is that they have a lot of the same fundamental problems that you have in general relativity. So when you quantize this theory, you get a problem of time. And this one is very similar. When you quantize, you don't have a problem of time. So it's interesting to compare the two. Why is it that in one model we have a problem of time, but the other we don't? And these relational theories, I think what they do is they put all these deep problems that we have in quantum gravity into a simpler perspective. So you can study the problems in simpler theories where we actually know how to solve the constraints. And maybe I'll just take a second to say, why is that interesting? The reason why it's interesting is because we spend probably 90% of our time here trying to solve the constraints of general relativity. Quantize them, right? But the fact is that even once we figure out how to do that, we still have big problems to deal with. And thinking about these things sort of bring us directly, or these simple particle models sort of have exactly the same problems. And so the point is that at some point we do have to own up to the fact that we're going to have to deal with these problems. So why don't we start thinking about them? So I'll say it now, and then I'll come back to this maybe at the very end of the course. It could be that at least the picture that you get is that maybe is not so satisfactory, right? Is that these problems might be just giving you a bad picture of what physics looks like when you quantize in general relativity. So maybe what it's saying at the end of the day is we shouldn't be quantizing generalizing. But anyways, that's something that I want to come back to you, and I'll just say it now. But that, to me, that's the reason why this stuff is important. All right, so that was a little side note. But back to Mach's first principle, which is actually what most people think of as Mach's principle. So let me just read a lot what Mach said now. So we say that a body K alters its direction and velocity solely through the influence of another body K prime. We have inserted a conception that it is impossible to come at unless other bodies, A, B, C, etc., are present, with reference to which the motion of body K has been estimated. So what he's trying to say is, look, if you have a body K and another body K prime, and one is moving with respect to K prime, the only way that we know for sure that it's moving somehow is because there's other bodies that it's moving relative to. So, and he goes on and he talks more about this in this quote, but his basic point is that that motion relative to some absolute frame of rest is irrelevant. We always have other bodies in the world with which we can measure the motion to, and it should be those bodies that are important. So that's typically what people call Mach's principle, is that motion is relative. It's trying to see how a body moves relative to everything else in the world. Okay. But I wanted to put up both quotes because really both of them are different concepts, but they're important. What I want to say. This seems like a fairly reasonable thing to say. It seems like a fairly reasonable thing to say. So why is it that, Newton didn't think of this? And obviously he did think of it. But he had a good argument to believe in absolute space. And this argument sort of stood the test of time for a long time. And it's the Newton's bucket argument. And I want to go through it. And I know that some of you probably already know about Newton's bucket. The reason why I want to go through it is because it actually highlights some of the features of a relational theory I'm going to talk about when I actually go through the Barber-Pinzoni model. Okay. So Newton's bucket is like this. There is a bucket, and you can attach a string to it, and you twist the string up. But in the first configuration, you have nothing is moving. You have water in a bucket, right? So I've actually done this for different high school students. It's not that hard. So actually, who's familiar with this? So if everyone here lifts up their hand, I guess you can go through it. Okay. Not everyone. Okay. I'll go through it fairly quickly. The idea is that you start with no relative motion between the water and the bucket, right? And things spot on anything. Then in the second configuration, you let the bucket go and it starts to spin. And for a brief moment, the outer walls of the bucket are spinning, but the water hasn't started to move yet. So what you have is you have a spinning here, and you have flat water. So if we kind of do a table of the relative motion of the water in the bucket in the different stages, this is stage one, and this is stage two. You can see that in the first one, there's no relative motion. And what you're looking at is sort of physical prediction of the theory. And in this case, you either have water flat, or eventually once the water starts to speed up, it's going to start creeping up the sides of the bucket. Right? So is the water flat, or is it concave? And in the first scenario, you have no relative motion, and the water is flat. Okay. Then in the third case, in the second case, you have relative motion and the water is still flat. So this is enough basically for Newton to already say, look, there's a problem with the relational theory. because a relational theory will give definite predictions based on sort of the initial, sort of the physical situation that you're in. So here you have two different types of relational motion with the exact same predictions, right? But then it gets worse, because if you imagine that eventually this water is going to start catching up to the bucket. So the water and bucket are going to be moving together. And so the bucket is moving, and the water is now moving, so the water is now starting to creep up the sides. And in this situation, you have no relative motion again, because both are moving together. But now the water is not flat. Okay. So now you have another problem. Here is no, here is yes, here is no, here is no. Right? So obviously your relational theory is not really doing a great job of being able to predict what's happening in this experiment. And then in the very last situation, you stop the outer walls of the bucket and you watch what happens to the water. So now the water is spinning still, so it's not flat, but the bucket has stopped moving. There's no... So here you have relative motion again, but the walls are not flat. So clearly you have different predictions for the same physical relative situation. And so because of this, Newton says, well, what's really going on here is that the water is moving with respect to absolute space, and the bucket is moving with respect to absolute space. And so if you just describe the theory that absolute space is real and motion relative to it, that's what's important. It's not the relative motion of the bucket and the water. Okay. So that is a very, that was a very good argument at the time. And it took a while for people to figure out what the problem was. So for those of you who know about this already, you know what the problem was, is that... the thing that that Newton is forgetting about is that it's not just a bucket and water in the universe, right? There's other things. And what's really important is the relative motion of everything in the universe. So, you know, what Mach would say, or what Mach did say, is, you know, you've got the Earth, and you've got Newton doing his experiment, holding his bucket and the water, and you have stars everywhere. And the stars are sort of pretty close to being fixed. And so what he's saying is that it's the presence of all this other stuff in the world. You have to look at the relative motion of everything, of the water and the bucket, with respect to everything else in the universe. And when you do that, you find that you have these stars that are much more massive and much more numerous than everything else, and they're approximately fixed. So it's the presence of these stars that is sort of giving you an emergent background that is approximately absolute. So it's giving you the reason why we have this idea that there is an absolute space is actually because we've got all kinds of heavy stuff in the world that is sort of creating this background space. I mean, that's about as detailed as Mach got, right? So I see a lot of people looking with funny faces at that, because it's a very vague statement, and I think that it wasn't the time of Mach. But the reason why I'm bringing it up is because in the Barber-Bitotti models, you can make that precise. So you can really say, look, if you have a lot of bodies in the world and they're massive, they're going to give you something that approximates the 20th absolute space and time. But if you reduce the amount of particles in your universe, then you get some weird things that are happening. And going back to the bucket, if there was only water and the bucket in the universe, what you would expect from a relational theory would be two possible outcomes. One, if there was no relative motion, you'd have something flat. And if there was relative motion, then maybe you'd expect something like this, right? So in a relational theory, you'd expect no and no, no and no, yes and yes, yes and yes. This thing. So it's true that the relational theory actually gives different predictions from the absolute theory. But it's only when you have a large number of particles that things tend to balance out. Or that it's very difficult to distinguish between the relational theory and the absolute theory. So that is, I think that's the key theme that I'm going to come back to. And that's what I'm talking about now. Basically, I'm getting all the boring philosophical stuff out of the way as quickly as I can, so that I can get to making precise statements. All right. So, where am I going with this? I'm getting to spatial relationalism. So if we want to construct a relational theory, how are we going to do it? I just told you the types of things we expect. We expect different behavior, all right? We expect the absolute theory to have different behavior from the relational theory, but what exactly is that difference going to look like? So what we're looking for is we're looking for a theory that's only going to depend on the relative distances between things. Okay, so now I'm sort of going to what Barber wants. So the ontology of his theory is he's got a bunch of particles, and this is in sort of free space. So say we have three particles, it's enough to sort of give you the picture. And you want a theory that's only going to depend on the distances between the particles. So somehow there's an assumption here that you can actually measure distances between particles. It's a fairly reasonable assumption. Or at least that you can measure ratios of distances. So I can take this distance here, this is particle 1, 2, 3. This would be distance 1, 2. And this would be distance 2, 3. And this would be distance 1, 3. And then,
do you use the metric on R2 to measure?
No, sorry, R. We'll see, this is R3. And no, this is just plot space. So let's just assume that we can measure that we don't have general relativity yet.
Okay, so
we have a plot. That's right. There's nothing very simple minded. There's an assumption that you can measure ratios of distances. So you can measure things like R12 divided by R13. And you can measure R13 divided by R23.
Well, is that assumption better than assuming you know the full distance between the bodies?
The reason is because, if you, as far as a relational theory goes, if I say I double this distance, right, how am I going to know if I'm inside that system when I double the distance, really? Because all I know is that I can go here, and it takes me, it might take me twice as long to go from here to here as from here to here, right? So really, like, the idea is that there should be some sort of scalar variance in this model. I'll just leave it at that. So that's why the claim is that this is more relational than actually being able to determine the distances exactly. Because how do you do that unless you have something to compare to? You measure distances maybe with a ruler, right? Then you have to make some assumptions about what that ruler. You double the size of the ruler and everything else, you don't change the theory. So that's the idea of scalar variance. And then, so now the idea would be to try to construct a theory in terms of these degrees of freedom. There's probably more than one way to do this, but early attempts to create relational theories in terms of these true degrees of freedom failed. And they failed because you get problems with mass and isotropy and other things. So there's a series of papers, I can give references if you're interested, where people tried. Schrodinger was probably the last notable person to work on this thing. And he just failed. He couldn't get a sensible theory out of it. So instead, the idea is to say, okay, instead of working directly with these particles, we'll work with coordinates on Euclidean space. So we'll give these particles actual coordinates. And then what we'll try to do is we'll try to treat it like a gauge theory. So, we'll have our configuration space, which is in absolute space. We call it the absolute configuration space. And then we'll have sort of points on, I'm going to put a point here, on the configuration space. And that will be a collection of positions of particles. So here, I'll call the positions sort of the I.
This is for
big I will be particle number, and little I will be space dimension. Okay. So these cues are just labeling positions of these particles, particle 1, 2, and 3, right? And so you've got an absolute configuration space that's defined with these on absolute space. And then you say, okay, there's an equivalence class of such points on this configuration space. Because I can take this triangle and I can move it. I can do translation to all the coordinates. So I can move it over here. It's the same triangle. So if I'm inside the triangle, I can't tell that I've just moved this triangle. Right? All I know is what I can measure inside my triangle. And so such a translation might be another point along this equivalence class of points. So you can map out sort of like a full equivalence process of points along this configuration space that are created by either taking a rotation of this triangle, a translation of the triangle, or a scale transformation. Right? Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to project all of this onto a relational configuration space. So now I have my relational configuration space, which is going to have a lower dimension because it's just a projection of all of these points onto one point. And so this guy will project to the point here, and this guy will project onto that same point. And then my physical theory is going to be a trajectory on this space. So I'll have some trajectory like this. It starts off here and ends here. And it's parameterized by something, which, anyways, we'll talk about it later. And over here we have the same thing. We have a trajectory, but this trajectory is not unique, right? So if I'm an observer in here, you know, and this, there's all kinds of equivalence classes at every point in the trajectory. I could go this way, and I could that will project down to trajectory here, or I could go this way, and that will project down to trajectory here. So the reason for doing this is that is I want to point out this has a lot of the same structures as a gauge theory. That basically what we're trying to do is we're starting on the absolute configuration space, and we're going to pick a section in this configuration space, a preferred section or a connection, and then we're going to use that to define a particular structure in the relational variables. So, yeah.
When do we start right away with an explicit relational function?
Yeah, so why don't we start directly with these? And that's, it's a good question, right? And that is what the first people tried to do. And all I'm saying is that, it would be worth going through and looking through this paper to see why things didn't work out. But the point is that it's easier to do it this way. And this is why you gauge things anyways, right? If you could work with the true degrees of freedom, that would be a lot better, right? Because you could quantize it more easily. But we work with gauge theories because it's easier to work with these other redundant variables than it is to work directly with these guys. And so as far as I can tell, that's the motivation here as well. Is that you have these redundant variables, but you want to use, so you want to work with those because they're nice and they're convenient. But really, the theory itself is defined on these relational variables. So
you say unphysical, redundant variables, simplified calculation?
Yes, simplified calculations. And that's true in general to me as well. Yes.
What are the dimensions of these spaces?
Well, I mean, this guy is going to be the number of particles to the dimension of the space. And this guy is going to be less dimensional. And that's a good question. It's exactly how much less of dimension.
You mean the 3n dimensional, you mean, right?
Yeah. Whoops. Yeah, that was a feed. Yeah. So this is three-dimensional?
No, 3n.
Or this is
dn.
Yes.
N minus one.
Yeah. Okay. So so then this guy's going to be less.
N minus one.
Well, it depends on the way that I drew here. It looks like you're just losing one dimension. But what is the dimension of these equivalence classes? That's the interesting question. So that's why I'm just about to sort of try to motivate now. But I'll get into more detail later. Is it so? What is really taking you from here to here? Well, you have a series of constraints, right? And so that's what we're really looking for. We're looking for constraints that will take us from this configuration space to this one. And for each constraint, we'll lose a one dimension. So it turns out that basically you get one constraint for each of the symmetries in the problem. So if here I have a translational symmetry, I'll have a constraint that tells me something about the momentum in that direction. And so so for this system, if we have three translations and three rotations and one scale transformation, we have seven constraints. So we're going to have a system defined on this space that has seven constraints, and it's going to restrict us to dn minus seven system.
That's only for d equals 3.
Yeah, isn't it simpler to just count the number of ratios and then it's n minus 1 for all cases? The parameters are the real constraints, R1, 2, R1, 3, right? These are the real physical degrees
right.
of freedom, and there's always n minus 1 no matter what.
No, that's not true. It's not true. Because that would be true if you're just talking about translations,
yeah.
right? But you also have rotations. So you basically got to look at the Killing vectors of this space, right? And so the Killing vectors, I don't know how many it's going to be.
So you're telling me that there's more, it's not always n minus one of these independent ratios? To me, it should always be n minus one of these independent ratios.
Big
n minus one, number of particles minus one.
Because here's the reason why it's not like that, right? It's because, so suppose I add, it's a bad example because I have three particles of two dimensions here. But if I have a large number of particles, I'm going to have, n minus one, right? Because ratios that I can form. But those ratios are not all going to be independent, right? If you just had a bunch, if you had like 100 particles, right? You don't have, 99 independent ratios working in theory. No, because those ratios are going to be constrained to lie in three dimensions, right? So at the end of the day, there has to be constraints to tell you that these ratios can actually fit into the three-dimensional space. And that's something else that is actually what makes these theories very difficult, is that yes, you have, there are 99 independent numbers that are all working independently. Somehow you have to get these to fit on inside a Euclidean space, okay? And they have to actually represent something like that, particles moving in free space. And so there's constraints on that, and that's what these constraints are doing. Right. So it's true. I should just write d equal to 3 because you're absolutely right that this number 7 is dependent on the amount of dimensions that you have. Okay. So in three dimensions, you have something like this.
In general, it's also not so hard, right? Because it's always the dimension of OD cross RD, right? This is the group that acts on it.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. You're connecting all the points to each fiber. And then you have this one more dimension, which is the scale.
I'm not going into huge amounts of detail now, but the reason why I actually wanted to talk about this is because we have this minus 7 thing, right? So whatever the amount of constraints are, you can see that this number, for a small number of particles, this number is large compared to 3 times n. Right? So if we have 2 particles only, it's going to be it's hard to have a system that works, right? But if we have a large number of particles, then the difference between this configuration, the dimension of this configuration, and the dimension of this guy is not so big, right? So that's actually the origin of this argument over here, that if you have a large number of particles, the difference between the absolute theory and the relational theory is not that much, right? Here you've got a couple more variables here that, so you have 7 constraints on 3 times n parameters. So so if you have a lot of, maybe I need someone to be better with what the constraints look like. So I'm going to leave this for now. Okay, this is just to give you a flavor of first, first what the problem is, right? What the types of theory that we're looking for, and then a general picture of how we're going to get there, right? So that's all I wanted to say. And so the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to talk about how much time do I get. So I'm just going to do, and that's what best matching is, right? Best matching is this procedure to take this, to find the constraints that take me from the absolute configuration space to the relational one, right? And I'm going to talk about that in detail. And then I'm going to show the connection to gauge theory. You can already sort of see that there's a lot of relationships to gauge theory. But it turned out that specifically, this is like defining a flat connection on the absolute configuration space. So I'm going to discuss the connection to gauge theory and possibly other theories. And then I'm actually going to show that this technique is more powerful than that. In the way that Julian sees this, you've got temporal relationalism and spatial relationalism. They're two completely different things. But it turns out that if you apply his techniques for best matching to the parameterized particle model, which has an absolute time, you actually you can get rid of the absolute time, and it becomes equivalent to Jacobi's theory. So that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about, I call it time-gauged, kind of polished into complicated for this, parameterized particle mechanics, to show that this is really, it's a technique that was derived in a particular context, but it's more powerful than that. And then finally, I'm going to end, hopefully, by talking about general relativity. So the first thing I'm going to do, so this is GR, is a warm-up. And that would just be best matching field theory. And then I'm going to talk about actual general relativity. And hopefully, at the end, I can talk about some interesting things that you can learn from the particle models and import into general relativity. Right? So that's the outline of the course. So I started this course by saying that I was going to be very specific, and then I made all kinds of very general statements. So I think that it's time to get actually specific and give you a flavor of what the course is hopefully going to actually be like. So let's get started. So I wanted to warm up with this parameterized particle model. So here, forgetting about relationalism for just a second, we're talking about particles, non-relativistic particles, and absolutes on Euclidean space. So we have a configuration, the picture is we have a configuration space of variables q, I, like this. And we're looking to define an action that will, whose possible trajectories an action that's minimized along the possible trajectory of configuration space, right? So that's what we're looking for. And the action that we're going to use is just the Newtonian action that everybody knows, with the T and kinetic energy minus potential energy. So the reason why I write T prime is because the kinetic energy is going to be a half times the sum over all the particles of the masses. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the derivative of these Qs with respect to time squared. So the prime is telling you that I'm taking a derivative with respect to t, because in a second I'm going to try to get rid of t, right? Because t is the thing that we don't want in the relational theory, right? Now the potential, we want to be a function of configuration space and not of t directly. So it's a fairly reasonable thing, like most fundamental forces. Basically, we want a conservative force system.
Sorry, is that just t prime?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Great. So this is, you know, something that should be familiar to us from the third year mechanics or something. But what we're going to do in this parameterized model is make t a configuration space variable. Okay? So instead of dealing with time, we're going to deal with some arbitrary parameter. So what we'll do is we'll every occurrence, we're going to parameterize t with some arbitrary parameter lambda. And then the theory is going to, and then t is going to become a little dynamic variable. So we're going to have this arbitrary parameter lambda. Sorry. Every occurrence of dt is going to be substituted with d lambda times d q naught d lambda. And I'm calling time q naught, because now it's going to be a dynamical variable. It's going to be a configuration space variable. Right? Now, I'll say that a dot is going to be differentiation of respect to lambda. And from now on, everything is going to be in terms of lambda. So all I'm going to do is make a substitution into this action. Right. So can you still see that? Let's do it here. So now our action goes to the action that we're interested in. And we've got a dt here. And we've got two dts down here. All right. So what this is going to look like is it's just integral d lambda times q naught dot times t minus v over q naught dot. And the idea is squared. And the idea is that this t is just the kinetic energy defined with respect to dots. So t about the prime is sum over I of a half mi is q dot squared. And this is the action that we're interested in.
Are you sure it's q naught there? Isn't it qi?
In the t.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I need to put this in the standard form. It's t over q naught dot minus b to q naught dot. Okay. So, okay, why is this an interesting theory? Because you get an equation of motion for the q naught in terms of the configuration, other configuration space variables. And that's interesting because it's sort of, you know, when we look at the equation of motion for this guy, it's going to be a function of the other q's, which is exactly sort of the definition that we want in a relation theory. Because we want time to be a measure of changes of things in the universe. But what we're going to notice is that this is an absolute theory, whereas Jacobi's theory is not. What's the difference? So that's the thing I'm going to focus on. Okay, let's look at the Hamiltonian of this guy, just so we can review the quantization, but also so that we can study this theory. So Hamilton, the momenta, we've got momenta, which are defined as the sort of derivative of the action with respect to Q not I. And these guys are just going to be, the action depends on the Q not dot through the kinetic energy, right? So if we take the derivative, we just get MI times Q dot II over Q naught dot. So you can see that this looks a lot like the definition of momentum in a normal theory, except that here we have derivatives with respect to lambda divided by this guy. Now, we also have momentum conjugate to the time variable. And this guy is a little bit more interesting. Q naught dot. That is just minus T of the Q naught dot squared minus V. Right? Which kind of looks like the negative of the total energy. Right? Yeah.
Is the knot supposed to be lower or upper? Like, is it a
should be upper, I guess. Doesn't really matter. Like, it's, I should probably be more careful, but trying to write Q's with upper indices in the space and P's with lower indices. Just because that's sort of what you would do if you had a covariant theory. But at this point, because the metric is just a delta function, it doesn't really matter. But I'll try to be careful about it.
I just meant, like, doesn't it refer to little I or big I?
So it should be upper in the sense that it's kind of like a spatial invariance. So it's not a particle number. So there's one time for all particles. I should be more careful. Now, this thing is kind of interesting because it looks a little bit like the total energy of the system. If you remember, the total energy is the potential energy plus the kinetic energy. But we've got this divided by the time thing here, which is good. But the other thing, the reason why let me start over. What we want to do now is we want to see if we can invert this for the Q dot and for the Q dot naught and the Q dot i's. Okay, so we want to be able to find a relationship between the momenta and the Q's. But you realize that at first you think, okay, this might be possible to do, but then you realize that actually these are coupled equations. And you have Q dot naughts here, and you have Q dot i's over here. So you have to sort of be a little bit more careful and work things out. And what you realize is that, indeed, this system of equations satisfies a constraint. So the momenta satisfy a constraint. And that constraint looks like this. The constraint I'll call H is if you take the sum of all the momenta of these guys, divided by the masses, and then you add the potential energy, that's just the negative of this guy. So you can check that, even it's not that hard to do, right?
There's a square on the p's.
Yeah, that's right. There's a square on the p's. So this kind of looks like a constraint in saying that the kinetic energy is equal to the negative of P naught, which is the negative of the total energy. So this kind of looks like conservation of energy, right? You can check if that's indeed the case. If you plug this guy in, you can see right away that this is going to give the sum of Q I dot squared over 2, and the mi is up here, plus v minus t over q dot o, and this is going to be divided by q dot dot squared outside, minus t minus v. So the v's cancel, and this thing is just the kinetic energy in terms of these guys. So sure enough, this is an actual constraint. So it's not possible to invert these momenta in terms of the q dots, right? Which means that we need to use sort of the Dirac procedure, because what we have is we have a system with constraints. And because it turns out this is the only constraint in the system, it's going to be a first-class constraint, which means we're going to have gauge transformations. Now, Julian just recently wrote a paper where he points out that the quadratic constraints like this actually don't generate true gauge transformations, original definition of Dirac. But that's another discussion. As far as I'm concerned, I'm just going to use the old language here to talk about gauge transformations and time gauges and other things. So this theory is very interesting because it has this type of constraint. But it's also interesting for another reason. And it's starting to run out of chocolates. And that's because look at what happens if you try to calculate the conical Hamiltonian. Right? So the conical Hamiltonian is going to be momenta, the P II's, and I'll put it somewhere where I'm very explicit, Q II. But I'll leave the spatial indices to some booker, just people at least know. Plus, there should be a dot here. Plus the momenta of the time variable times the dot of the time variable. And then we're going to subtract the Lagrangian. And this should be a function of the q's and the p's. But we don't even have to do that. We can actually just plug in these definitions here, and we'll see right away that something interesting is happening. So if we plug in our definitions, we've got sort of the sum over I of mi qi dot over q dot dot, right? And then this guy is square. So this is like the square of the kinetic energy. Two times the kinetic energy. Plus p naught times q naught dot. Well, that is, there's a minus sign. There's a t over q naught dot squared plus b times q naught dot. So you can see there's already a cancellation between one of these guys in this term here. Now we write down our Lagrangian, which is somewhere. It's Lagrangian as I remember it. So the Lagrangian is going to be t over q naught dot minus q naught t. Oh, so there's a minus sign here, which means that these guys are canceling. And this gives the second term to cancel off this guy. So this whole Hamiltonian is zero. And now again, this is a generic thing. You can prove that for parameterization invariant actions, you're always going to have zero Hamiltonian. Now this is the same thing that we have in general relativity. We have a Hamiltonian that is zero, and it's proportional then to the only constraint, which we call the Hamiltonian constraint. So now we have a theory that's very similar to general relativity. It has a quadratic Hamiltonian constraint. And that constraint is generating the reparameterization variance, essentially. Okay. So what's the next step? But there is a difference between this and general relativity. And actually, this resemblance has sort of seduced a lot of people for a long time. Dirac, in his original lectures, used this theory as an example of theory with a constrained Hamiltonian as a way of sort of like talking about the features of general relativity, because I think he had that in the back of his mind. Also, Kukoc and other people have been interested in these types of theories to say, look, general relativity is just like this, but this theory has an absolute time at the end of the day. And that's because we started with a theory with absolute time, and all we did was make this variable substitution. Right? So is it possible that general relativity has this absolute time built into it, and we can get back to it? That was one of the things that was interesting and motivating for them. But they found that you can't really do that. And we're going to see in a second that the reason, at least the reason I think why, this is different from general relativity. Since the general relativity does not have an absolute time. General relativity is a lot more similar to the Jacobi theory, which we're going to talk about next week. And so I think I'm starting to run out of time. How long should I go to? Because we started like 10 minutes late. I don't have much more to do. I think I'd like to maybe make one point about difference between this.
I think so. Just find a good place to stop.
So. Yeah, okay, so a natural stop. All right, so I've been able to work out the Hamiltonian, and now I want to use the Hamiltonian to calculate the equations of motion. Yes. Okay. So our total Hamiltonian is going to be the causal Hamiltonian plus the constraints, and we'll put a Lagrange multiplier function of lambda times this Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. Right. And of course, this is zero, so this is just n of lambda times sum over I, the momentum squared, plus v dot.
Usually, if you put the eraser, it stops then.
Oh. I put the eraser.
But it stopped.
Okay, it stopped.
So hc is equal to the h curly print in this particular case.
Hc is zero.
Well, hc is identically as a function zero,
yeah.
And h curly is a constraint.
Right.
So as a function, it's not zero.
Yeah. It'll be weakly equal, so when we apply the equations of motion, it's going to be equal to zero.
Right.
But sort of off shell, it's not. Mm-hmm. So just a preview, because I won't get to talk about it today. When you're quantizing this, the constraints are promoted to operators, and then the operators act on the wave function. So then this becomes an operator constraint on the wave function. So if you look at what this constraint is, if I put a little hat on, this is the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, because this p hat turns into a di by dt. Right? So anyways, it's an interesting way to derive the non-relativistic Schrodinger equation. Okay. Right. So what are the equations of motion? What do they look like? Well, the first one is the first one to look at is QII. Is the Poisson bracket this guy with the total Hamiltonian. And you can see that, it's going to come up here, right? So we're looking for all the occurrences of P, the momentum in here. And you can just take the derivative. So you get P I I over M. Did I screw that up? No, times N. Okay. So it's just like it would be in the normal non-relativistic theory, the momentum is proportional to the mass times the derivative. for now we have this factor n, which is an arbitrary Lagrange multiplier. Okay. Now the second guy, so the Hamilton's first equation for the time, is going to tell us, give us a good idea what this n is supposed to be. Right? So if we take the commutator of this guy with the total Hamiltonian, we see that there's only one occurrence of this momentum. And so this is proportional to that constraint. And so n is what n is really doing is it's giving you a particular parameterization of the time. So n is a time gauge. It's telling you what the derivative of the time variable is. Okay. So if we just sort of plug this in, put this up now. Now we can finish off by looking at the equation of motion of the momenta. For this guy, we have pi total Hamiltonian. So I didn't write it explicitly, but the potential is a function of the cubes. So when we're taking the plus on brackets, we get a negative sign because the phi is on the other side of the v, and then we just get the derivative of this v with respect to but of course we still have to multiply by this Lagrange multiplier. So now we're almost done. There's a somewhat trivial equation of motion for the derivative of the momentum conjugate to the time variable, and that is that it's zero because there's no Q naught in this expression. So what it's telling you is that P naught is a constant. And so we can call that constant the total energy. Right? So that's sort of like what we were saying earlier. This is conservation of energy. Right? Now we have equations of motion that tell us that on shell, we actually have a constant of motion, which is the energy. And now we can get Newton's laws back. Because what we can do is we can try to combine these and put them into second order form. So we can take this guy and this guy, and we get something that looks like. This guy is P dot I equals M I times Q dot I over N, right? And now the derivative of this is going to be the derivative of this thing. So actually what I want to do is I want to bring the n right here. So on the n to come out there. And so if I take the derivative of this guy and I go 1 over n, okay, so that means that d by d lambda of mi is q I dot over n times 1 over n is going to be equal to this thing, minus I v by q I I. So let me know if my handwriting is not very good. I know it's not very good. You can't read. So the thing that I want to notice is that there's a di by di lambda times n here, and a di by di lambda times 1 over n here. And that sort of is making you think, well, actually, what you can do is you can say, like, I want to define, So n is q naught dot, right? So I can just plug q naught dot into here. And what I get is that n is q naught dot, so that I can rewrite these derivatives as derivatives with respect to q naught. And that will give me
there's a blackboard thing.
I think if I erase this. So
send it up.
The point is that n times d lambda is equal to, according to this equation of motion, q d by d lambda of q naught times d lambda, right? So this thing is just d q naught. So what we can do is we can substitute m d lambda for d q naught. And what we find is that we have, since the n is not a function of q naught, we have m I times d squared q I d q naught squared equals minus I d q I. Okay? This is just Newton's laws in terms of this variable q naught, which is time. Right? Now, you could have gotten this more quickly if you had just set, pick the gauge n equals 1, and then this equation right away turns into Newton's laws, but with lambdas instead of q naughts. So that is the kind of an important feature. There always seems to be a distinguished case where the equations of motion in terms of the dynamical variables look like a simple version of these equations of motion, so that they simplify. And in this case, Newton's laws, which is what we're used to, are sort of the form that you get by taking the distinguished gauge in this particular gauge theory. The last thing that I want to say is that you can write the constraints in terms of these quantities as well. And what you get is you get that T prime plus B equals E. And T prime, that's the derivative in terms of the Q naught. So again, you get back from just plugging things into the Hamiltonian constraint. So what you're seeing is that on shell, you have Newton's laws expressed in terms of this dynamical variable q naught. And there's two ways to look at that. You can look at it either as a gauge choice or as something that's gauge independent. Because this equation of motion and this equation of motion is gauge independent. Again, maybe that's the point I'm trying to make, that you can pick a gauge that looks exactly like the gauge-independent equation book at the end of the day. And that might be something interesting for general relativity, because even in the Barber-Bertoni models, the same is true. There's always what Julian calls a distinguished representation, which to me is a preferred gauge, where the gauge-independent equations of motion are like trivially equal to the equation of motion you get in that gauge. That might be interesting to learn that. Yeah.
So you had promised us time as a function of all the other variables. We didn't really get that in this case. Is this because it's a time-independent theory?
We did get that. I'm just a little bit slow in getting to where I want to go. And I was going to stop there, but since you brought it up, if we look at this guy here, all right, we can rearrange him. Because it looks like the T prime is really, is that what I want to say? No. That is what I want to do. So So we got the sum over I times mi. So what I want to do is I want to rearrange this and solve for it in terms of dq naught. Now I could also probably the better thing to do is to keep this in terms of the lambdas and then rearrange it. But if you do that, and I won't go through the details, is that you find that q naught dot is equal to sum over I mi over 2 times qi dot squared divided by b minus b. And then you take the square root here. Alright, so you can kind of see that that's the equation you get. Right? This is lambda independent. And you can kind of see that because this is lambda independent. So if I get rid of the lambdas, I've got a d out here, and then I've got a d in here. So that's what I meant by now you have time in terms of the configuration space variables. So this is basically the equation of motion. This is the first order form, second order form of the equation of motion that you got from this theory. You use the constraints and you plug things in and rearrange, and you get something that looks like this. And this guy is telling you that the amount increment of time that goes by is proportional, and you forget about these factors, to how much all the variables in the world are changing. Yes?
But is there some problem in, what configuration you evaluate the
Which configure? So there's an issue about if I have a trajectory on this configuration space. Which gauge am I in? But this d is not doesn't depend on a particular choice of lambda. So what I'm trying to say is that if I look at how much time has ticked along this little arc length of curve, right? So what I'm actually going to do is I'm just going to look at the actual arc length. I'm not going to look at the lambda. Now I could do that, but what I would find is that this particular thing is independent of any parameter that I'm going to pick. So this is actually a function just of the little d here, dq by I. It's something that's defined just on the configuration space with the vector that you get here. And not lambda. Ultimately there in another dimension, lambda parameterizing this. You get different curves in that space. But this guy here is independent of any parameter.
So the statement that your formula gives us an explicit dependence of the time lapse in terms of the other configuration variables.
Yes.
I'm feeling a little bit uncomfortable with, because so far I have not seen among Mach's principles how to find out about E and V explicitly, right? So as long as that is not specified, it just smells like a big circular argument.
Yes. So that's precisely the difference between this theory and the Jacobi theory.
Okay.
Is actually where E comes from. Now, how to determine the potential? That's actually a broader question that I'm prepared to answer right now. But for now, the potential is just there's some experimental way to determine what the potential is. But it's very important to look at what the foundations of this theory are, and here we're assuming we know what the potential is. We're assuming that we can use an ansatz for the potential and then check to see if that ansatz is consistent. But the question of E is one I want to address right now, because here you can see that what do we have? We've extended our configuration space to include Q naught as a time variable. So what we want to do is we want to specify initial conditions for the QIs and also for the Q naughts. So there's some initial guy and then there's some final guy. This integral, so this we can integrate, right? And when we do that, we notice that this side of the equation is going to turn into just the difference between the initial, the final, and the initial conditions, right? So we've specified some lapse of time. So we've said, look, in the way that we set this up, this much time has passed between this point and this point. That's the way that we treat time in this theory. And so this integral is constrained equal to this. So we have to pick an energy that will allow this to happen. So in other words, in this theory, the energy is determined by the initial conditions. What are the initial conditions, and how do we specify those? That's a more complicated question. But in this theory, that's how it works. So energy, the total energy is set once you know the initial conditions. Okay. Basically, the idea is you give me some initial conditions, I will find a classical trajectory that will minimize the action. Once you have that, that trajectory will have a very particular energy. Right. In the Jacobi theory, it's going to be the opposite. The energy is going to be a parameter that you set from the theory. And then these initial conditions are not going to be specified. And that's more similar to the case we have in terms.
So at the end, it looks like the choice, if one wants to define time in terms of all other assumptions, including the knowledge about the potential, or if we go the traditional way of defining potential or force in terms of having explicit knowledge of time. But I don't see how one can really break out of either taking one or the other choice.
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult. So yeah, what it boils down to, and I'll get more into this next week, is it boils down to a choice between specifying this lapse of time, which is sort of, you can only do it in absolute theory, or specifying this energy, right? And you have to do one or the other. But the nice thing would be is if you had a principle that could say that the total energy of this theory is zero. If there's a preferred, for some reason, the energy of the universe is equal to some specific value. So if you had a principle that would tell you that, then you could say, okay, we know that E is equal to zero, and therefore we know for some initial conditions on the QI what the system is going to do. And that's sort of what I would think.
So just to try to clarify, so I think the general point made is that it's an overstatement to say that we have reduced time or duration to position measurements, because you need to know E, you know, also the masses. If there's V, there might be other constants in the potential, right, like gravitational constants and so on. And one needs to, in order to reduce everything to positions, one needs to have an independent way of determining those.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So
it's true.
And that problem hasn't been solved. So.
No. But keep in mind that this is the situation in general relativity as well. E as a parameter plays the role of the cosmological constant. So there's analogous things that happen in general relativity, and so any problems that occur here are also pulling and carrying through to GR. These are important issues. I like this model because it kind of is a nice way of introducing these concepts. Obviously my credit over time. This is a good place to stop.